This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, how is the global shortage of pilots affecting the Pacific, and why are some locals saying that there's an over-reliance on foreigners in the region? Also coming up, the multi-billion dollar project to bring electricity to 70% of PNG's population by the year 2030 has been launched, but it's highly ambitious. So how will it work, and what energy sources will be used?
So if you look at all of these different sources of renewables, we believe that renewable would play a dominant role.
The government there, though, is looking at multiple options, including coal energy. Are there recommendations that you can provide to the PNG government?
We would only be able to kind of talk about what PNG as a country could do by exploiting its renewable resources.
More of that interview coming up later in the program. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for your company. First, though, airlines across the world are buckling under a global pilot shortage, and it's being felt in the Pacific too, with major airlines and flying schools in the region trying to adapt to a dwindling pool of experienced pilots. But despite these concerns, Air Vanuatu has recently announced plans to grow its fleet with 8 new aircraft. It's welcome news for some pilots in the region who, as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, believe that the problem is not a pilot shortage, but an over-reliance on foreigners.
As more people look to the skies, the demand for experienced pilots to take them there is rising to sky-high levels. A report from the aircraft manufacturer Boeing predicts that over the next 20 years, a staggering 200,000 new pilots will be needed to meet air travel demands in the Asia-Pacific region alone. This pilot shortage is hitting home in the Pacific, where people rely on air travel to commute between islands. Tim Joyce owns and operates the Pacific Flight School in Fiji, which trains pilots across the region.
Because there's a worldwide shortage of airline pilots, they're all recruiting and taking pilots out of general aviation at, I suppose, much lower experience levels than they did previously, which means there's a real shortage of middle to high level experienced pilots in general aviation.
Mr. Joyce says the shortage means that experienced pilots, who once would have been used as student instructors, are being targeted and poached by airlines abroad. It's a situation that's forced many airlines to reassess their regular services. In PNG, Air New Guinea reduced its flight schedule last year, with the CEO telling local media this was in response to factors in other countries, factors which included the global pilot shortage. But there is one airline in the region that has taken a different approach, expanding its services where others have contracted, and that's Air Vanuatu, whose CEO is Derek Neese.
We have a 10-year plan. And over the course of that 10-year plan, we will be training, hiring, and developing a large number of pilots who are recruited here inside Vanuatu.
Air Vanuatu will be introducing new aircrafts to its domestic and international fleet as part of a shared plan with the Vanuatu government to boost tourism.
Yes, I think the pilot shortage is a global phenomenon, and it's not going to get better in the near future. But I think that we're in a good position because we do have a big pool of well-educated people here in Vanuatu that we can draw from.
But not everyone is convinced that Vanuatu has the infrastructure to train pilots to fly the large jet planes used for international flights. The deputy chair of aviation at Swinburne University in Melbourne, Stephen Fankhauser, is doubtful about Air Vanuatu's strategy.
For an airline like Air Vanuatu, I would imagine it would be very difficult for them to train ab initio, or we call beginning pilots, right from scratch, and then have the training infrastructure within the airline to build them up through a cadet program. So I would imagine that they would be looking to go out on the marketplace and acquire pilots who are already qualified on that type of aeroplane. And of course, that means they also will be on the marketplace with China, with the Middle East, with the United States, with others.
It's this international demand that might strain Air Vanuatu's budget. And CEO Derek Neese agrees that the trend for foreign airlines to poach experienced pilots from the Pacific poses a risk to his company's expansion plan.
Oh, I think that's a risk that we most definitely have to be concerned about.
But there is support in the country for Air Vanuatu's strategy, particularly among those who would like to see an end to the airline's dependence on foreign pilots. Pilots across the region argue this use of foreign expertise is only adding to the shortage, with some local pilots like Captain Granger Narara from Milne Bay in Papua New Guinea saying that they've been forced to go overseas to find well-paid work.
That's the first Papua New Guinea to work abroad as a pilot.
Captain Narara is currently based in the United Arab Emirates, where he flies for Etihad Airlines.
We all left home to go look for money because at home, we don't get incentives and we're getting paid less than our expat counterpart.
Captain Narara says the demand for experienced flight crews has reached fever pitch. And if Pacific Airlines can't compete, they may well miss out.
It's Priyanka Srinivasan reporting there. A Chinese Fijian resort developer that's allegedly breached Fiji environmental laws could face further charges, according to the country's Director of Public Prosecutions. The Fiji government officials are alleging that the company Free Soul Real Estate Development, which is behind a planned resort on Malolo Island, violated a prohibition notice from the Ministry of Environment. It's accused of digging a channel that's damaged the foreshore, removing mangroves, and there are also allegations of poor sanitation. The people there say has contaminated the fishing grounds. Dr. Kenneth Chambers is a lawyer acting for some of the landowners on Malolo Island.
The resort's in the construction stage at the moment, and the effluent from 40 workers, you know, the sewage coming out of their toilets, is going straight into the lagoon, no treatment, out the pipe, into the... And this is their fishing ground. So they've got clams and crabs and that are living on raw effluent from a construction site.
It's also been revealed that there were court orders out against the company requiring it to stop construction on the foreshore. The Fiji government's announced late on Thursday night that it will now be prosecuting the company. But the timing of that announcement has raised some eyebrows, given it came following New Zealand media reports out that day that had revealed the extent of these allegations. Meanwhile, the Environment Ministry has confirmed that it actually had filed a case against the company to the Director of Public Prosecutions in September last year, and that have been investigating it since June. Stephen Pratt is the head of the University of South Pacific School of Tourism, and I spoke with him a short time ago, and we began by talking about that timing.
Yeah, I think it was quite opportunistic of the developers given the timing of the election. So there was probably some uncertainty about, a little bit of uncertainty about which the incumbent government was going to stay in government and whether, you know, the responsible decision makers, Department of Environment in particular, but also a range of other government departments, whether the same people would be, you know, in place after the election. So there was a little bit of a vacuum there where I guess decisions weren't being made and that may have led to, yeah, trying to push it through at that particular time.
So regardless of the allegations here of the environmental damage, etc., what about the actual proposal of this particular resort as well? I understand it had originally planned to be what the largest resort in Fiji, 350 rooms was what it wanted, many of them burets over the water as well. How would that impact on Fiji's tourism industry? And is that a sustainable type of model, particularly there on an island that already has plenty of other resorts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the initial plan, I'm not sure, presumably the developers and at least the director, my readings of the newspaper was that he is, although of Chinese ethnicity, that he's a Fiji citizen or passport holder, presumably that he, you know, knew about the area. But yeah, it's quite a densely packed island already. And so the questions of sustainability and what type of tourism you want, I guess, is important, I think, to Fiji and Fijians. The question maybe 10 or so, 8 to 10 years ago, the question of whether to have a casino was brought up and there was plans for that at on Denarau, and that didn't go ahead. So and there was a lot of media public outcry about not having a casino then. So to certainly suggest one, even though it was off Viti Levu, you know, and quite isolated, question of sustainability certainly would be raise a few eyebrows to have such a so many burets built and to have the type of tourism where casinos there is pretty not very sustainable.
It is, as you say, though, already a popular area with plenty of resorts currently there, although much smaller. I understand some of those resort owners are those that are involved in the legal action and sought the court orders, etc. as well. Is there any chance that some of this is just about not wanting another larger competitor that could, of course, hurt their businesses? Or, as we've seen from some of the photos, you believe that there is absolutely grounds for the Fiji government to prosecute and concern over the impact on the environment?
I certainly think there's grounds based on the evidence for prosecution. Yeah, you could also argue that the resorts there don't want another competitor, although my discussions with them were that they were, you know, not, they just saw that as, you know, part of competition, and that the new resort was going to actually target different markets than the existing markets that the existing resorts were targeting, more the, you know, the families and Australian New Zealand market, whereas the new resort was being, you know, targeting more an Asian market.
Stephen Pratt, she's the head of the University of South Pacific's School of Tourism. Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama's recent announcement that he would attend this year's Pacific Islands Forum meeting has been seen as a significant improvement in his country's relations with Australia. He'd boycotted the event for several years because of what he said was Australia and also New Zealand's undue influence over the regional organisation. But what does Mr. Bainimarama's change of heart mean for the body that he set up to rival the Pacific Islands Forum? That's the Pacific Islands Development Forum. Liam Fox has investigated.
In 2013, Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama welcomed leaders and officials to the inaugural meeting of the Pacific Islands Development Forum.
Today, Your Excellencies, we come together to launch a new era of regional cooperation, of solidarity and of friendship. We are building a new framework for Pacific Islanders.
It was an impressive start for the PIDF. Among those in the crowd were the leaders of Timor-Leste, Kiribati, Nauru, Solomon Islands, Micronesia and other small island states, as well as diplomatic representatives from China, Kuwait, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates and Russia, but not Australia and New Zealand. Many observers at the time saw the creation of the PIDF as an attempt to rival, even usurp, the Pacific Islands Forum after Fiji was suspended from the regional body following the 2006 military coup led by Mr. Bainimarama. He said as much back in 2013.
Why do we need a new body? Because the existing regional structure for the past four decades, the Pacific Islands Forum, is for governments only, and has also come to be dominated only by a few.
Even after Fiji was readmitted to the Pacific Islands Forum, Mr. Bainimarama still refused to attend the annual leaders' meeting because of what he said was Australia and New Zealand's undue influence over the organisation. But all that changed following Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison's historic visit to Fiji last month and the commitment to a new Vuvali, or family, partnership between the two countries. Not long after the visit, Mr. Bainimarama announced he would attend this year's leaders' meeting of the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu.
That means that alternative forms of regionalism that were used by the Fijian government to get a voice in the region and internationally may not be as important anymore.
Dr. Michael O'Keefe is the director of the Master of International Relations at La Trobe University and was a consultant to the PIDF in 2015. He says Mr. Bainimarama's re-engagement with the Pacific Islands Forum could have a major impact on the PIDF.
The PIDF is very focused on climate change issues and in particularly around the Conference of Parties, and so it has a place, but if Fiji is engaging, then it won't be part of that sort of public diplomacy and won't be needing to have sort of very large summits as it had in the past.
But it seems the PIDF's role and the emphasis put on it by the Fiji government had already been changing for some time. There hasn't been a leaders' summit since 2016. The most recent event listed on its website is for a symposium on marine conservation in December 2017. One insider told Pacific Beat the PIDF was in a kind of limbo, one where the Fiji government didn't want to kill it off because of the potential embarrassment that might cause, but it wasn't pumping the money and support into it that it once was. Tess Newton-Kane from TNC Pacific Consulting says the PIDF's focus has changed since its inception.
We've seen it move very much into quite a sort of technical area around issues to do with green growth, blue carbon initiatives around oceans management, renewable energy. So a lot of work with the Global Green Growth Institute, which is quite different from where it started, where it was much more political.
Whatever the future holds, Dr. Michael O'Keefe says the PRDF can claim to have had a positive impact on the organisation it was set up to rival, the Pacific Islands Forum.
There has been calls for more inclusive leadership and governance in the PIF, and we've seen some changes to the way they've involved civil society groups. The agenda has been focused on climate change, on green growth, on blue oceans, and this is, could only be seen as a positive development for Pacific Island nations and for the Fijian government.
It's Dr. Michael O'Keefe from La Trobe University, ending Liam Fox's report.
Pacific Beat.
Parents of students looking to attend the University of Papua New Guinea have been taking to social media to express their objections to the size of the fees, and their frustration has only increased when it appeared that a rise was going to be on the cards. The government has stepped in and appointed a completely new interim council, and the fee hike has now gone away. But as Richard Ewart reports, the issue of fees remains a nationwide concern.
While there's been something of an outcry in academic circles over the installation of an interim council at UPNG, hard-pressed parents are not complaining after that council opted to rescind the decision of their predecessors, which would have resulted in a fee hike. Prior to the council's move, the Higher Education Minister, Pilar Nyiningi, had assured parents of students at UPNG that there would be no price rise. The fact that that policy is in place now will come as some relief to parents who took to social media to complain that fees are already too high. But Dr. Cecilia Nambu, the president at another of PNG's higher education institutions, Divine Word University in Madang, says the UPNG debate conceals a far more serious issue linked to fees. She says it was established by government 5 years ago that at a minimum it takes 30,000 kina to cover the cost of educating one student for 1 year. But Dr. Nambu says parents can't afford anything like that sum, and as a result, her university is doing it tough.
So for Divine Word University, we charge them 10,000 kina a year for all other programs, 12,000 kina for the MBBS program for medicine, and 11,000 kina for physiotherapy. Rehabilitation sciences. So that means the balance of 20,000 or more is being subsidized by the university. So people like myself or the staff have to work very, very hard to make extra money to keep the university open. We don't get a grant from the government like UPNG does.
Would-be student Suli Suli says his family can't afford even those subsidized rates, and as a result, he says he's had to sideline his university ambitions until he has enough money to pay his own way.
It's been hard for my mum, who's been paying for myself and my siblings' school fees. Last year, my brother didn't go to school because mum couldn't afford it. This year, I decided to find a job so that my brother can go to school. I already have a job offer from Ramu Nikhil in Medang, so I will work and save up and go back to uni next year.
Against that background, at Divine Word, Dr. Nambu says even a small increase will be greeted with dismay by parents who, she says, have been misled about the true cost of education. So any attempt to impose a fee hike on UPNG was always likely to fail.
The government is saying UPNG cannot increase fees. Well, that's not my business. That's between the government and the university. But what I know is that I know how to run a university, and I know you cannot run a university with 8,000 kina a year per student. Most parents think it's 8,000. It's not 8,000. It's 30,000 kina a year. They think it should be 8,000, and when we increase it to 10,000, some parents started jumping up and down.
Students like Suli Suli are not untypical of those who would like to be part of the university system, but the costs are simply beyond them. And those costs escalate for medical students, as a result of which Dr. Nambu says tackling a shortage of skilled staff in PNG's health services is very difficult.
You have to buy equipment. You have to buy laboratory equipment, laboratory agents, all kinds of things. Much, much more expensive to educate a medical student. Papua New Guinea is crying out loud for health workers. They've got to be trained. They are not cheap.
It's a situation that would appear to be crying out for a cash injection from government rather than extra fees from parents who can't pay them anyway. But for now, at least, there seems to be no real answer. And universities like Divine Word continue to struggle.
It's Richard Hewitt reporting there. Well, the highly ambitious multi-billion dollar project to bring electricity to 70% of PNG's population by the year 2030 has officially been launched by the country's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill.
People are close to 8 million plus people inside the country, believe me. That's all less than 1 million you got excess low power. 7 million, believe me, you missed up low boost yet.
That is the Prime Minister of PNG. You can hear him there saying that with a population of 8 million, less than 1 million have access to power. And he said that this planned project will transform the country. Now, we also specifically thanked the, quote, traditional donors who were funding the project. That's Australia, New Zealand, the United States and Japan. Many close observers have seen this project that's set to cost around $1.7 billion as an attempt by those countries to compete with China in funding crucial infrastructure projects in the Pacific. Now, despite the official launch happening late last week, there's still a lot of detail to be revealed about this project, including exactly what energy mix will be used. The IFC, that's the International Finance Corporation, has been working with the PNG government, providing advisory work. And the man leading that is Subrata Barman, who I spoke with earlier.
You know, as you rightly pointed out, I think the details of that is being worked out. Even we don't have access to, you know, the details of, you know, how it is going to be done. But if you look globally, there are examples, you know, where you have seen that there has been rapid, you know, increase in electrification levels. I don't recollect the exact number, but, you know, I think a country that comes to my mind is Laos, where right now it is almost 92% of the people have access to electricity. And if you just go maybe 10, 15 years back, you know, it was in the range of 30-40%. Once all the, you know, all the factors are at play, then, you know, I would like to believe that you can actually achieve a significant, you know, electrification rate. That's one. The second, you know, issue I would say with respect to PNG is we believe that there would also be a lot of off-grid solutions that will come in. So think of mini-grids. You know, whether it is the islands or even, you know, difficult to reach places, sometimes, you know, you may not necessarily need the grid to go and serve people. There are other technologies, there are other business models that are emerging where you can set up a mini grid, which would be a generation, maybe a small amount of transmission and distribution, and it would supply pretty much the same levels of service which normal, you know, grids would offer. So in our discussions with the government of PNG, we believe we have heard that almost 25% of the people of PNG would be served through off-grid solutions.
And when we talk about it being off-grid and these kind of mini projects on islands or I suppose in remote parts perhaps of the highlands, etc., mm-hmm. what energy sources, is that more likely to be renewable energy in those circumstances? And which are the ones that are perhaps best for PNG?
Yeah, you know, there are two parts to the question, right? One is, is it going to be renewable or other sources? You know, definitely renewable would be one of the sources, but you also need to understand and look at what is the best way to... There are two challenges that these grids are facing. Or if there are no grids, then how do you provide service? One is reliability. It's very, very important to provide reliable and cost-effective power as cost-effective as possible. So sometimes it could be a mix of renewable and some non-renewable sources. For example, if you look at PNG, gas, there's a lot of gas that is available within the country. And our understanding is that the government is going to come out very soon with regulations on DMO, domestic market obligations. Besides that, there's a lot of hydro potential, which everybody is aware of. There are large and small projects being pursued. And on top of that, there's significant part of PNG which will be served well with solar projects. The World Bank is actually carrying out an assessment of the wind potential in the country. So if you look at all of these different sources of renewables, we believe that renewable would play a dominant role.
You talk there about how important you think renewable energy will be to help electrify PNG. The government there, though, is looking at multiple options, including coal energy. It does appear that there is division within the PNG cabinet, some ministers very much in support of it, describing it as clean coal. Mm-hmm. But of course, we've seen others less convinced. And of course, there's growing movement around the world to move away from coal as an energy provider. Are there recommendations that you can provide to the PNG government on where to be looking at? Obviously, it wants to diversify its energy sources. Is mm-hmm. coal an option?
You know, our focus has always been in renewables energy. As a World Bank Group policy, we do not support coal. We do not have information beyond what is available in the public domain. So we would only be able to kind of talk about what PNG as a country could do by exploiting its renewable resources.
Sprata Barman from the International Finance Corporation there. Well, that is all for Pacific Beach this morning. Don't forget, we're on in the afternoons as well from 3 p.m. PNG time, joined by Richard Hewitt. And at any stage you want to listen back to us, you can find us on our website. Just type Pacific Beach and Radio Australia into your search engine to find us. We're also on Facebook. Find and like the ABC Radio Australia page. Our stories will turn up in your feeds.